listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the Monroe Doctrine on its 200th birthday, messy American politics in 1823, messy American politics in 2023.
You can't understand the Monroe Doctrine without situating it in the really messy domestic politics of the United States. And that's true in the 19th century. That's even true today when you've seen this curious revival of the Monroe Doctrine in American politics here in 2023, of all things.
And Cambodia's Great Lake, the Tonle Sap. It's a story about fish.
If you talk about Cambodian people, you talk about fish. Even fish sauce is made of fish. So every meal, they eat fish. Everybody eat fish.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. It was a convoluted but portentous American declaration. Quote, "The occasion has been judged proper for asserting, as a principle in which the rights and interests of the United States are involved, that the American continents, by the free and independent condition which they have assumed and maintain, are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers, we should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and safety." And to be clear, quote, "With the governments who have declared their independence and maintained it, and whose independence we have, on great consideration and on just principles acknowledged, we could not view any interposition for the purpose of oppressing them or controlling in any other manner their destiny by any European power in any other light than as the manifestation of an unfriendly disposition toward the United States." You guessed it. The Monroe Doctrine, drafted by U.S. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, enunciated by President James Monroe in his 7th State of the Union address to the U.S. Congress in 1823, the doctrine's original intent was actually anti-imperial, French meddling in the Americas in mind. Too weak to enforce it, young America turned to the British. As U.S. power grew, so did Monroe's doctrine. From the 1840s till the Cold War, it would be the source code for a host of policies aimed at projecting American might up and down the Western Hemisphere. Manifest destiny, the big stick, the big brother policy, America's backyard. What was the Monroe Doctrine all about, and how has it been reinterpreted over the past 200 years? In search of answers to these questions, I reached out to Jay Sexton. Sexton is author of the 2011 book, The Monroe Doctrine, Empire and Nation in 19th Century America. What was the Monroe Doctrine, right? I mean, I grew up in the United States, and I've always thought of the Monroe Doctrine as something kind of American imperialism and manifest destiny and used to support and buttress the foundational foreign policy for so many what would some would interpret as negative activities of the United States. What was the Monroe Doctrine? It was enunciated by James Monroe, of course, in his seventh annual State of the Union address in 1823. It was written by John Quincy Adams. Tell me about the doctrine and why it was enunciated.
Well, you know, right away it's important to note that the message, Monroe's message in 1823, is quite a separate thing from the subsequent doctrine. And this is where your high school history school books still get it completely wrong. You know, when the Monroe team and John Quincy Adams, as you mentioned, he's Secretary of State, playing a pivotal role, when they're drafting this message, which is, as you say, it's actually not like a standalone message. It's part of an annual message to Congress, what we now call the State of the Union Address. So just a couple of paragraphs in that much longer message. But when they're drafting this and they're trying to devise a response to a threatened European intervention led by France to squash the Latin American independence movements. And this is the sort of climax of the Latin American revolutions. And there's rumors that the French and some of the more reactionary European powers are going to move in and squash it. You know, when they're responding to this situation, the key thing to note is they are not drafting a binding doctrine of foreign policy. There's no evidence for that. You know, rather, they're just trying to, you know, fudge their way through a really critical moment and issue. And so they come up with this new rule that they announce. It's actually not that new. People in the United States have been saying this for a while, that European monarchical powers are different than the Republican governments that are taking root in the New World, and that the two political systems need to be separated. So that's what they say in response to the crisis. But there is no evidence that they want to make this a binding doctrine. It's very little noted at the time. Very few people in the United States or outside the United States take note of what Monroe said. And it just sort of passes into obscurity until it's later revived by subsequent generations of American politicians. So I think that that's the key point. It's totally different than like the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, in that this is a reactive kind of one-off. It's not an attempt to build something, to build that tradition that the school books still want us to think Monroe and co. were doing.
I want to get back to that maybe at the end. Like, why is it and how is it that the school books get it wrong? But let's set that aside for a moment. It's interesting that in 1823, European powers, primarily France, were talking about intervening in the New World to squash revolutions. And I'm thinking about what was going on in Haiti with Toussaint Louverture. I need to jog my memory when that was happening and when the French were trying to intervene and to put a stop to that. But the French were thinking about doing that elsewhere.
Yeah, that was beforehand.
Yeah, that was in the late 18th century.
That's right. That was beforehand. And don't forget that you have this talk about a country that pinballs all around the ideological map. France in the days of the French Revolution and giving way to the sort of Napoleonic era and Napoleon. And all this is happening after that, after 1815, when France has a much more conservative, traditional political regime after 1815. I mean, it's revolutionary era. Well, at the time, people think it's revolutionary era is a thing of the past. Of course, that won't be the case. And France will continue to convulse in revolutions. But all the more reason, if you're the conservative French elites, that you want to prevent the contagion of revolution, and that you would have seen, they saw the contagion of revolution wreaking havoc on the social order of their own country, and they didn't much like it in Spain's empire, even if it was all the way across the sea.
And it's interesting that the French and the Americans were allies during the War of 1812.
Yeah, and there would be no United States without the French alliance of 1778 in the revolution. But this is a different era after 1815, and you know, the critical player in this whole episode is Great Britain. It's not the United States. It's not even really France. It's the British. And the British, by this period of time, have decided that the Spanish Empire is a thing of the past. The opportunity for Britain is to profit from cultivating new trade relationships with these new countries in Latin America. So Britain actually also wants France not to intervene. And the British cut a deal with the French actually before Monroe gives his famous message to Congress that resolves the whole crisis. And the French agree with the British that they won't do this. And the Americans don't even know that this has happened because it's in that kind of phase of secret diplomacy in the old world. But yet another reason why Monroe's message itself in 1823 was a total nothing burger, because the actual crisis had already come and gone unbeknownst to Adams, Monroe, and the Americans.
And the British, I gather, the British kind of supported the Monroe Doctrine. It was unenforceable by the United States. because the U.S. didn't have a navy at the time, and the British swept the seas and had a very powerful navy. So can you comment on this? And I mean, how did the British hear about the Monroe Doctrine, and how did they interpret it at the time?
It certainly aligned with their policy. The British had actually sounded out the United States on not a formal alliance, but on a joint declaration, joint action on this issue. And the Americans demurred, just kind of kicked the can down the road because couldn't decide whether or not to ally with their hated former colonial master. So the policies itself aligned. But this is really the beginning of what's going to be the headline for the next century in the geopolitics of the Western Hemisphere, which is, you know, Spanish decolonization, the emergence of these new Latin American republics, and then Great Britain and the United States vying and competing for influence, for market share, later on for imperial possessions and holdings. It's the Anglo-American competition, which paradoxically takes place within this kind of general environment of agreement that the Latin Americans should be nominally independent, but that the two English-speaking powers are going to compete to see who gets the upper hand. And that's the headline for the next century of the kind of grand strategy of Western Hemispheric geopolitics.
And what do the Latin Americans think about the Monroe Doctrine? How did they find out, and what did they think about it?
You know, didn't think a whole lot of it. They would have found out from it mostly in newspapers or through formal diplomatic channels. There's some commentary from the time. Some obviously applauded it. Others maybe raised an eyebrow even early on, suspecting that this nominally anti-imperial declaration might cloak or mask American Yankee designs for creating their own empire. You can find a few quotes to that effect from this period of time. And then early on, when the Europeans would violate Monroe's declaration, the Latin Americans would appeal to the United States for support and would normally be disappointed. A great example is when the British take the Falkland Islands. This is just about 10 years after the original 1823 declaration. The British take the Falkland Islands from Buenos Aires. And Buenos Aires, you know, writes the letter to Washington being like, hey, they violated that thing. Are you guys going to stand by us? And the administration of Andrew Jackson just, you know, says, no thanks. We'd rather have the Falkland Islands in British hands. It'll help our trade and commerce down there. So I think that is an early example of what's going to become a significant theme in Latin American reactions and perspectives on the Monroe Doctrine, which is that it's a bunch of hot air, that the United States doesn't stand by its anti-imperial commitments. And you'll find Latin Americans saying that time and time again.
So when did the Monroe Doctrine begin to start getting instrumentalized by American administrations to extend their influence to Latin America? And I'm thinking here in 1842, the doctrine was applied to Hawaii in an attempt to annex Hawaii by, I think that was the Polk administration.
Yeah, I mean, it is the Polk administration that really trots out the Monroe Doctrine or the Monroe's message. I mean, for the first time, it's included in an annual message again. This is in 1845. Actually, the Hawaii stuff was the Whig administrations and Daniel Webster. And what Polk does with the Monroe message is rather different. He essentially says, all right, that message was really important. The United States cannot allow European powers to entrench their interests in America's sphere of influence. So he agrees with it. But he changes it in two important ways. First, he says this doctrine only applies to North America. It's not the whole hemisphere. So he doesn't care about South America. In fact, during his administration, there's an early, kind of like early Pan-American conference, I think organized by the Peruvians down in Lima. And Polk's like, We don't want to send a guy down there. We don't care about that stuff. We just care about North America. And this leads to the second way in which the Polk reading of Monroe's message was very different from the message itself. And that is, he uses it not just as a prohibition on European action, but as a justification for assertive American expansion. And so it's in the Polk days when Texas is annexed, when the war against Mexico unfolds, when the northern third of Mexico is seized from Mexico and the United States gets California. And of course, there's a settlement further north along the 49th parallel of the Oregon Territory. That's all during the days of Polk. And Polk, the aggressive, assertive U.S. imperialist, is responsible first for reviving the Monroe Doctrine, but now linking it to a program of American imperial expansion.
Manifest destiny.
Absolutely. But here's the thing about those school books again, David. Polk never uses the phrase manifest destiny. He never uses it. He uses Monroe's doctrine. That's really the one that he thinks has the most political utility for his project.
Who coined the term manifest destiny?
John O'Sullivan. John O'Sullivan, Irish-American, and I think it's always important to note that he's an Irish-American. So he sees manifest destiny not really in like the hard-headed realpolitik terms that Polk does, but he sees it in an ideological sense, that it's like a celebration of Republican government and democracy. And if you're an Irish immigrant, and you know, you would hate the British Empire and British imperialism, and you'd celebrate American democracy. And of course, Manifest Destiny does get linked in, obviously, to the continental expansion, but it's not really what motivates a hard-headed thinker like James K. Polk.
And in 1870, Ulysses S. Grant's failed attempt to annex the Dominican Republic based on the Monroe Doctrine. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, here you see, so now Civil War is come and gone. Slavery's gone. American foreign policy is in the midst of a slow but very important transformation. And we're kind of building up, aren't we, to 1898 when the United States goes to war with Spain and takes Spain's former colonies, the Philippines and Puerto Rico, Guam, occupies Cuba, takes Panama. What Grant is doing is a sort of early precursor to that. And he looks at Santo Domingo and he sees this, as a Civil War general would, as like a real important hub in logistics of supplying a new steam navy. And, you know, they're all about now coaling stations, protecting the envisaged Isthmian Canal, which Grant also wants to dig. He's, again, ahead of his time here, and sees the Monroe Doctrine as a justification for these actions. And can we just say here, David, like when we start looking at the different episodes in which the doctrine is invoked, you know, an important theme emerges. And that is, you know, what is the Monroe Doctrine? And I think it's quite simple. The Monroe Doctrine is a political symbol. It's nothing. It's not like a roadmap. It doesn't give American policymakers a clear sense of what they're supposed to do. It's not like, here's the rules, go follow them, go implement them. What it is, it's a nationalistic symbol that has great recognition and potency in American democratic politics, and thus is seized upon or exploited by all these different statesmen and administrations who use it to justify whatever it is their favored course at that moment. And what we'll see is that people debate about what the Monroe Doctrine means. It's not just a symbol of imperialism. I mean, the anti-imperialists are the ones that really seize control of the doctrine. They're the one that most effectively attach their programs to this imagined nationalistic symbol. But that game will go back and forth. And so that takeaway here, what I'm trying to spit out, is that you can't understand the Monroe Doctrine without situating it in the really messy domestic politics of the United States. And that's true in the 19th century. That's even true today when you've seen this curious revival of the Monroe Doctrine in American politics here in 2023, of all things.
Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. But so what you're saying is that the Monroe Doctrine was a kind of a vague statement 200 years ago, which has really been taken and reinvented and reinterpreted by American statesmen and diplomats for their own particular purposes. But those purposes always seem to be to further America's influence in the hemisphere, obviously, to extend American power, to project American power.
Yes, but no. So I agree with everything except that last point. Let me give you two counterexamples. First, in 1898, the aforementioned kind of year that colonialist outburst of the Spanish-American War and when the United States takes the Philippines and so forth. If you read the newspaper columns from that year, if you look at the debates in Congress, if you search digital databases for Monroe Doctrine, what you'll find is that those that most are likely to use it or invoke it are the anti-imperialists, not the imperialists. The anti-imperialists, the ones opposed to taking Spain's former colonies, say that that is a violation of a nationalist tradition embodied in the Monroe Doctrine. That the imperialists need to explain for themselves why they're in favor of taking these island possessions and creating a formal colonial European-style empire when James Monroe, back in 1823, announced that that was the antithesis of American foreign policy. Yeah? So that's 1898. I mean, they don't win, the anti-imperialists. They come a hell of a lot closer than a lot of people think. I mean, they only lose that vote on the Treaty of Paris in the Senate in 1899 by one vote. So I would say that that episode shows the protean nature of the Monroe Doctrine, but also how anti-imperialism was a more significant force in American politics than many often give it credit for, and how the Monroe Doctrine was one of their favorite symbols. Another example, let's fast forward. Let's fast forward to the 1930s. The 1930s, America is in the midst of that kind of so-called isolationist moment, and Europe is on the cusp of war. War has already broken out across the Pacific when the Japanese have invaded China. And American politics is consumed by this question of what should the United States do? Now, this is another period in which the Monroe Doctrine is very prominent in American politics. It is appropriated by both sides. Both the internationalists and the isolationists present their policies as an extension of this imagined nationalist tradition. But by far and away, those most likely to invoke the doctrine are the isolationists. They're saying, you know, Monroe was clairvoyant. He foresaw this kind of thing. He realized how we need to cordon ourselves off from aggressive threats across the sea. And that's what the doctrine's all about. Now, I will give you this. The isolationists in the 1930s, they're not isolationists at all. They're just in favor of like a hemispheric American empire. So for Latin Americans, yes, the Monroe Doctrine talk would still place them in a subordinate position to a regional power of the United States. But it's not as if the isolationists are like advocates of full-blown American empire, at least as it will appear in the post-war period. So the doctrine does not always, it's not always the symbol of outward-facing, assertive American foreign policymakers.
But it was instrumental in projecting American economic power and the interests of American corporations throughout Central America, particularly, you know, going back to the 1920s in Nicaragua, the United Fruit Company, all those banana republics, where these countries, where the United States felt it had the right to overthrow regimes.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Was the Monroe Doctrine articulated at that time as the enunciating doctrine underlying, you know, the overthrow of regimes from Nicaragua to El Salvador, Guatemala?
That's right. I mean, there's what is there, two, three dozen interventions of the United States in Latin American sovereign politics between 1898 and the mid-1930s. So this is the period you're talking about. And yes, the Monroe Doctrine is one of the more significant justifications for this. And this is the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, articulated in that same form that Monroe did his original message. Roosevelt, this is Theodore Roosevelt, uses his annual message to announce this corollary, as it came to be called, this corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which essentially said that, you know, when there's disorder in America's sphere of influence, and when there's the possibility that Europeans might intervene because of that disorder to protect their interests, that the United States needs to preemptively take action and intervene itself. So this is when the doctrine goes from Monroe's defensive, reactive prohibition on European powers to an explicit justification for U.S. Intervention and imperial rule in these Latin American and mostly Caribbean and Central American republics. I just say one more thing about the Roosevelt corollary, David, and that is that it speaks to the domestic politics of this issue once again, because what Roosevelt does in 1904 is he shrewdly appropriates the favored symbol of his political enemies at home, the anti-imperialists. And it had been the anti-imperialists, as I say, that had used the Monroe Doctrine in denouncing or in opposing Roosevelt's active and interventionist foreign policies. He steals their thunder, as it were, takes their symbol and uses it to justify his action. The anti-imperialists are totally outfoxed in 1904. And if you read their correspondence, they're just beside themselves, pulling their hair out about how their real symbol, they really believed that the Monroe Doctrine was anti-imperial. And they couldn't believe that the American people had fallen for Roosevelt's trap and that he had stolen their symbol from him. So it's both the shifting geopolitics of the United States in its sphere of influence and the vicissitudes of domestic politics which account for the Roosevelt corollary.
And who were these anti-imperialists?
They were older, backward-looking Americans, many from the old Civil War generation.
I mean, name names. Who were they?
Oh, I mean, former presidents. Grover Cleveland was an anti-imperialist. George Boutwell, former Secretary of the Treasury. They were liberals, as in like classic liberals, believe in small government. Carl Schurz, another one, a Missouri senator, very famous German-American political figure. They could be Republicans, they could be Democrats. They were actually from all over the political map. But as they say, the thing that they most had in common was their age from a different generation of American politics. And the imperialists were younger, more forward-looking, more attuned to currents in other countries, and seeing that this was the beginning, as the 20th century dawned, of a more competitive international environment, and that the United States, if it wasn't assertive and proactive in its foreign policy making, that it would be left behind.
And did these anti-imperialists believe that the United States should simply refrain from intervening in the affairs of other countries and behave in a serene manner towards administrations that were pursuing a totally different course of economic development in the United States?
Many did, yeah. I wouldn't want to romanticize them too much. I mean, a lot of them held their views for reasons of racial thought. So, for instance, you know, let's not help Cuba. You know, Cuba's full of Catholic people, speak Spanish, with brown skin. We got nothing to do with that. You know, we just want to protect our own little white democracy. And so there's a connection between anti-imperialism and the rise of Jim Crow segregation among some, like, Southern politicians of that era.
So they were sort of isolationists.
Yes, many were proto-isolationists.